Good morning, everybody. Happy March. It is March 1st, 2024. This is Tales from the Heart, a podcast from the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association. And today I am joined by our dear friend, Dr. Matthew Martinez of Atlantic Celts, Morristown Medical Center, sports cardiologist and HCM expert. Matt, where are you today?
Oh boy, still in Indianapolis. We are just finishing up the last day of the medical evaluations here at the NFL Combine. Trying to protect those hearts.
Not every cardiologist has the opportunity to screen a bunch of professional athletes like this. So the NFL got a lot of attention last year with DeMar Hamlin's cardiac arrest on the field. Yeah. What's it like doing a screening for professional athletes, and what's it like working with the NFL?
As you know, I do stuff with all the professional organizations, and it is absolutely a privilege to do it. And the design behind it, of course, is to identify, diagnose, and then develop a safety plan. I try and figure out what their risk is. You know, diagnosis is key. It helps their family. It helps them. It helps make sure that they are safe, that we can avoid tragedies. It is a different environment to screen in. And I think this is really important to point out that there's a lot of resources that the professional teams have and a lot of the high-level collegiate teams have that in the community are not present. So it allows us to do an echo, an MRI, a stress test within a 24 hours, 12 hours, sometimes 6 hours to come to an answer. And that's what allows us to do this more freely. And as you know, screening for athletes has never been able to save lives using ECG. We've only been able to diagnose. And that's really important. And there are some racial risks with this. But, you know, race can play a role in this. More false positives in Black athletes, Hispanic athletes compared to whites, and men compared to women. So there are some potential harms with it that we have to grapple with and struggle with, but we have advantages because the resources are so great.
We hope that all of those hearts are healthy.
So far, so good.
When we're watching them out there being really active, that's a bit demanding on the heart, and you want to make sure that they are all healthy. So really cool part of your world. Let's take a pivot real quick just to kind of look back at what we just left, which is Heart Month is over. It was a long Heart Month because it was a leap year this year, so we had an extra day. But we did a lot during Heart Month. It was HCM Awareness Day just 2 days ago, and we had a great presentation here with lots of our partners talking about where we're going with HCM, so it was a really exciting time. I just want to give a big shout out to all the families who shared their story through Heart Month, all of our clinical partners who did a lot of extra effort in education, awareness, media outreach, et cetera. Thank you all so much for all your participation in Heart Month. And now we get on with the rest of the year. I feel like I have like two Christmases now. It's Christmas happens in December, and then we immediately are moving into getting ready for Heart. Then I feel like I finally am calming down for the year so far. We're looking forward to a lot of great things in the year ahead. And thanks to all those who participated in HCM Awareness Day and Heart Month. March for the HCMA, we kind of focus on different topics each month. And managing arrhythmias is kind of the topic for March. And our subtopic is living with devices. Matt, what are the most common arrhythmias in those with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy?
We think of these as being from the top chamber. Atrial arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation is when the heart goes out of rhythm. And you talk about it as a flip-flopping in your heart. It feels like it's pounding. It can feel like you're anxious. It can take your breath away. And absolutely the most common arrhythmia is atrial fib. You can have its cousin, atrial flutter, which is a little bit of a different mechanism. Same kind of fast heart rates. You get that sensation where your heart is beating really fast. Both of those put you at risk for symptoms, but also put you in HCM in particular at risk for clot. And then you can have other stuff, PVCs and APCs. Those are just extra beats or skip beats. Atrial tachycardia, where the heart rate just goes fast, but not quite irregular. Those are the more common stuff from the top chamber, but atrial fibrillation sort of clearly ruling the roost. The one we worry about the most is from the bottom chamber, right? Ventricular tachycardia. That's from the muscle part, the pumping chamber part. And those can lead to cardiac arrest. They can make you pass out. People can describe that they just feel like their heart is beating, pounding very quickly. That can also take your breath away. Some people even describe impending doom, which if you're a clinician listening, those are words we should heed. right? In this condition, if the patient tells you beating fast, I felt like I was going to die. Those are scary words for me and really require some added level of protection. And then of course, ventricular fibrillation is when the heart stops. That's cardiac arrest. Different than a heart attack where you get a blockage in the heart artery that leads to damage to the heart muscle. And then you can get rhythms related to that. But in HCM, the heart is beating 1 minute and then not beating the next. The only way to fix course is with a shock.
Those are the big topics. And then we're going to take a little bit of a dive into each of them. Let's talk about the more benign arrhythmias. So CVCs, PVCs, we feel them. Some of us can have quite a significant PVC burden. What is a PVC? Let's start with that.
PVCs are extra beats that come from the bottom chamber of the heart, and APCs are extra beats that come from the top chamber, being the ventricular, A being the atrial. So PACs, top chamber, PVCs, bottom chamber. In general, they're benign. They don't cause harm to you directly, as long as they're, as your grandmother would say, in moderation. If you link a bunch of them together, especially PVCs, it becomes VT. If you have tons of them in total, even if they're singular or doubles or triples, when you get hundreds and thousands of them, they can lead to heart muscle weakening, which can then lead to complications. But when we call them benign, we're talking about risk for death and for major complications. But if you have them, if you're a patient with them, they don't feel so benign. They are uncomfortable. They feel like things are bad and it can really scare you. Patients tell me is that I feel them, that I dial myself up, I get nervous, then I get a little more anxious, and they keep going and keep going.
Cat chasing its tail.
100%.
PVC, you get nervous, you drop some adrenaline because you're nervous, your heart beats a little bit faster, you feel the PVC is a little bit more adrenaline, more PVCs. Stop. Take a breath, relax. Meditative breathing, bring yourself back down.
Yeah, and then there's some things you can prevent as you're sort of touching on. Those are ways to undo it once it's there, but they can be brought on by lack of sleep, by anxiety. They can be brought on by excessive caffeine. Maybe you've done something to make yourself bigger, faster, stronger, right? You want to get a little better workout, so you take a little pre-workout or a Red Bull or an extra couple of cups of coffee. That can dial it up. If you have sleep apnea that gets untreated, that can do it. Of course, alcohol can do it. Alcohol is one of those triggers where I'm not suggesting you can't have alcohol, but if it's something that generates rhythm changes, it may be something you need to curtail or eliminate altogether. So there are some things you can do to help yourself. I love what you said about deep breaths and meditated breathing. You know, this is a chance to take a moment in a quiet place. No TV, put the phone away, really try and calm yourself down. That usually helps. And then hydrate. You got to hydrate. Usually dehydration brings it on. A lot of patients will call at night and say, I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. And this morning I woke up and my heart is just racing. And I remind them that hydration is still key for all parts of HCM. So kind of the usual stuff to get yourself out of trouble in this. And then on occasion, there's too many of them and you need therapy. You need a medicine pill in the pocket where you keep it with you, and you might pop a pill like a beta blocker, calcium channel blocker, maybe even something stronger to try and melt away those PVCs. That would be something you'd really want to talk to your HCM expert about, because it's not something that you want to dabble in because your sister does it or your neighbor doesn't necessarily mean it's safe for you. Some of those drugs are equal safety amongst all folks, and then some of them are actually much more dangerous in HCM than other conditions. So that's a really important conversation with your doctor.
Those are PVCs, PACs, feel the same, have the same triggers typically for most people. We just posted a blog post here so that people can go back and read it about know your triggers, chocolate, coffee, alcohol. What are your triggers? I know some people who cheese is their trigger. I don't quite understand the mechanism of that one, but it's definitely their trigger. So if you're having arrhythmias, one of the things that we recommend you do, we have an HCM journal that we provide to all of our members. Note what you ate 24 hours in advance, what you did 24 hours in advance, and see if you can help identify what your own individual triggers are. That can be very helpful for management over the long term. In that vein, I was thinking about my dad earlier today, who's no longer with us. My dad's trigger was chocolate and his arrhythmia of atrial fibrillation for my dad. So it turns out my dad thought he was allergic to chocolate most of his life. And at 60, he decided he was going to tempt fate and see if he was really allergic to chocolate. And it turns out that he's no longer allergic to chocolate and he can have chocolate now. So my dad would kind of overindulge on occasion on chocolate. A story when my dad was at my niece's 8th grade graduation. So both of my nieces graduated together. They're 10 days apart. And we went to a restaurant and my dad wanted a piece of chocolate torte. And I looked at him and I said, you know what's going to happen here. And he's like, but I really want the chocolate. I'm like, you're going to need to be cardioverted, Dad. And he said, I am not. Don't jinx me. Well, he had the chocolate. And 6 o'clock in the morning, my mother called and said he drove himself to the hospital. Whoa. So I walked into the ER at St. Clair's in Denville, where he was going to be cardioverted for the 8th or 10th time. And I walked in and I said, told you so. And he's like, shut up. Some people are quite predictable. Let's talk about atrial fibrillation and HCM. About 25% of people are going to experience it in the course of their disease. Why is it important to really manage AFib carefully in HCM?
And if we go back to your dad briefly, sometimes patients tell me that and say, look, there are things I can't avoid. I drive late sometimes and it sets it off if I have a trigger. We can create a plan for them, right? There's a way to get him out of trouble if, depending on the scenario, and that's where that pill in the pocket may come in. But atrial fib, I think about this as a disease that causes a significant amount of symptoms, very common, up to 25% of folks who have symptomatic. And then if you add in those that are detected on devices, if you've got a pacemaker or an ICD, we might find another 20 or 25%. So it can be really common and burdensome. And we think about it first and foremost as symptoms. It can make your pumping function go down. We're seeing that certainly now more than ever, where we're monitoring folks more frequently because of new medicines and such. And the atrial fib symptoms can be quite dramatic. And it can also lead to pumping function weakening. And if you leave it untreated, little by little, it definitely leads to a higher morbidity and a higher mortality. And that data early on suggested it didn't make any difference, but we have data from Ethan Rowan specifically that suggests that if we can aggressively treat it and get you into rhythm more frequently, you're going to do better. That can be treated with antiarrhythmic drugs, can also be treated with ablation. Often it requires both. This is a complicated disease to manage in HCM, often the most difficult part of managing them, keeping folks in rhythm. I think most of us would agree that you got to be somewhat aggressive on this, that once you start to have symptomatic atrial fib, you kind of got to be suppressive of this and not just cardiovert folks every couple months and pray. Usually we get a little more aggressive with therapy. And then the thing we worry about the most is stroke, right? This is its own entity for stroke. When we talk about atrial fib in other diseases, we talk about a risk score to quantify who might benefit from blood thinner and who might not. And in HCM, it's pretty easy. If you have symptomatic atrial fib and it's prolonged, certainly over 24 hours, you're going to benefit from being on a blood thinner long-term and probably for life because of the higher risk of stroke with HCM and atrial fib. Under 24 hours, it really is a shared decision-making discussion. What's your age? What's your risk? Other factors, how big is your atria? What's your pumping function look like? Do you have obstruction or not?
Left atrial dimension. When we're doing a navigation call with somebody, one of the key factors that I'm looking at is what is the left atrial measurement? Are they dilated? Are they severely dilated? Are they mildly dilated? Can we discuss a little bit about the anatomy of the left atria and why it's important to have great imaging to understand that anatomy?
You know, the left atrium sits right on top of the ventricle, and there's a hyper focus on the ventricle and often what the mitral valve looks like. Is there SAM? Is there not SAM? Is there obstruction? What's the gradient, et cetera? All important factors. But the left atrial size is a big part of this. Left atrial enlargement comes from mitral regurgitation. Outflow tract obstruction, we think, plays an important role in rising of the size of left atrial enlargement. Certainly genetics play a role into this. And then diastolic dysfunction, where the heart muscle doesn't relax well enough, is the hallmark of HCM. The muscle's too thick, it's a little stiffer, and it doesn't relax well. So that raises the pressure inside the pumping chamber. That gets transmitted backwards towards the left atrium, then it gets bigger. So you're doing an adequate echo, looking at this in more than one plane. In the old days, we used to just do a straight measurement, just a diameter. These days, volumetric assessment, where we can measure the entire atrium all the way around it. Left atrial volumes using 3D or MRI are all playing an important role to understand that. The take-home message is the larger the left atrium, from whatever the mechanism, the higher the risk for atrial fib. And it's a bad marker. The larger the left atrium, it usually means that the pumping function is either reduced or that the pressure inside the ventricle is too high. And it's a marker that things are going in the wrong direction.
When we're assessing HCM anatomy early on, and every time we do it, we're really looking at a number of different factors. But the one that I think sometimes sneaks under the radar is that left atrial enlargement. And the longer we have pressures in the ventricle that go unchecked and that they're too high, and the longer you have some regurg going back up into the atria, the more this stretch is going to occur in the atria and the more risk somebody's going to be at for atrial fibrillation. My number is like once they hit 5.0, you see people popping right into AFib and it's really hard to get them back out. We really need to be focusing on the ventricular health to keep the atrial health as positive as possible. Would that be appropriate?
And I'll just add on to that, that the ventricular health is also related to the rest of the person. So we can't forget that there are comorbidities that go with HCM. As you know, this disease of longevity, and with longevity, you often develop hypertension, sleep apnea, you don't exercise, all of which leads to higher risk for atrial fib. So if you've got untreated high blood pressure, that leads to higher pressures in the ventricle and all the worsening that goes with HCM. If you've got sleep apnea and you don't treat it, it leads to higher pressures in the ventricle and higher pressure in the left atrium and so on. So one of the things to remember is that the left atrial size should be a bell that we've got some work to do. Is the ventricular pressure 2 a.m.? Is the obstruction need to be dealt with? Is the patient hypertensive and untreated? Do they have untreated obstructive sleep apnea? And although not a specific trigger to deal with the outflow tract obstruction, if you have somebody who has outflow tract obstruction and they have atrial fib and the left atrium is getting bigger, this is really a time to take a breath and say, maybe I need to do something about that outflow tract obstruction. Because again, we know that if you remove that, risk of atrial fib goes down with time.
Critical points. Thanks for diving into atrial fibrillation. The other thing that I just want to bring up is there's a lot of us who were out there for a long time with HCM being managed with beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, old school drugs, and really not getting rid of our obstruction or the mechanisms that are at the core of why our hearts beat too hard. So over time, we have these extensive pressures, and a lot of people who are maybe in their 50s, 60s, or maybe even early 70s, I'm seeing them have more issues with atrial fibrillation. We have to get in front of it now. So if they're going for surgery, they may also consider a MACE procedure to alter their risk of arrhythmia. Left atrial appendage clip during their surgery might be done. And possibly, like my father was one of the very few that I know that had actual surgery to reduce the size of the left atria. It is possible. My father did set a record at Cleveland Clinic with a left atrial dimension of 8.5.
Oof, a dubious distinction.
Yeah, he Nick Madeira had to do some fancy footwork on that one. Atrial dimension is critical, but given everything else, we have ablations that we can use to manage this. But ablations leave scar behind, so they're not benign procedures. They're pretty significant. Some of them may need to be done multiple times. There's convergent therapy, which kind of goes through and does a deeper ablation. There's a number of different techniques that can be used during these atrial arrhythmia ablations, and it's really important to try to medically manage them as well. I know we can use things like Tecasin and Sotalol. How effective are they?
I think Sotalol is our go-to most of the time. Tecasin would be second line. And then amiodarone is probably our best atrial fib drug, but it's also our worst in terms of side effects. So those are the big three. They're moderately effective. And it really has to do, in my opinion, with how quickly you get to the individual. So once the atria is too big, most of those drugs are not going to be beneficial. And then you've got to do some fancy footwork. Do we do them all at one time? If you wait too long, the atria is huge, going in and out of atrial fib frequently, you're in real trouble and you kind of need to be very aggressive. Maybe it's Sotalol plus an ablation, talk about an epicardial ablation and get some high level discussions for sure. I like what you said about the ablation, leave scar tissue behind. There's some potential harm with that, but it will make people feel better. There's no question about that. I think the days of going to MACE procedure alone for atrial fib are probably not here anymore. I do an exhaustive search to some degree before surgery. If you're headed to myectomy, I'm looking for atrial fib ahead of time. Can we do some things prophylactically so I can get this all done at once? Because we know that post-op, the risk of atrial fib is not small. I'm usually medicine first, then plan for the ablation, and then usually it ends up being both. The medicines themselves, I would say, as a sole entity, if you look at the data, it's somewhere between 30 and 50% effective at that middle dose, sort of depends on how old you are and your other comorbidities. But it's far from the 70, 80, 90% that I think most folks think it might be.
In our data with the clients that we've worked with all these years, the first attempt of an ablation, 40% success rate for keeping you out of AFib for over a year. A lot of people have to go back for that second attempt, and typically that's got another 40% success rate. And by the third one, it's more down to like a 20% success rate. But technique is different. Operators are different. High volume matters. High volume matters.
No question. And then earlier matters, right? I mean, I think you need to be mindful that if you let this go for a decade with an obstruction, we're probably setting you up for failure down the road.
We have a viewer here who's listening on Facebook and has a scheduled ablation through the groin, and he's scheduled for it. She's scheduled for it. And I'm hoping that's going to help her feel better. And we know that this is a tried procedure, but I do encourage you to use a high volume center of excellence for your AFib ablations for HCM, because we do not function the way other hearts function here. Think about that.
And I'll tell you, stay tuned, right? I mean, there's still some discussion about the technique itself. The technique is not the way it was years ago. When I first started, they were 10 or 12 hour procedures. Now they're under 4 for the most part. And there's a discussion about radio frequency. Do we do balloon cryo? There's some other techniques. Rotors were discussed at one point. It's still an evolving process, and as you say, it often requires a second ablation. I don't consider it a failure. I just think it's part of the process, right?
Yeah, you don't want to burn too much. So let's talk about radio frequency versus cryo. Radio frequency is using heat. Right. Cryo is using cold, both to get to the point of killing the tissue and separating the pathway so that arrhythmia doesn't have a place to go. It terminates in a certain location. Really important to make sure that you know which you're doing and that you communicate it well as to what was tried in the past.
Right, and it doesn't stop the atrial fib. It prevents it from coming out of those pulmonary veins. The veins stick into the back of the atria, and then they sort of burn around them to prevent the atrial fib from coming into the atria and sort of taking over the rhythm. And it can be very effective. But as you say, volume matters. Sometimes you get an incomplete circle around the atrial of the pulmonary veins. And when that happens, it sometimes requires a touch-up procedure.
I think our hearts are a little bit more crafty than other hearts, and we build new pathways.
Yeah, no doubt.
We find ways to get through that burn. So that's the atria. Now let's talk about the scary arrhythmias. So the ventricular arrhythmias. And I'm going to start in the rare spot, and then we're going to go to the more common. So let's talk about people with left apical aneurysms. That is a trigger spot for an arrhythmia. Why would an aneurysm predispose somebody to an arrhythmia?
The tip of the heart is where that aneurysm occurs. And the term aneurysm is challenging for the non-clinician, because when we think aneurysm, if you Google that, which of course everyone does, you'll find brain aneurysms, you'll find aortic aneurysms, of which those tear and rupture, and those are scarier than a left ventricular aneurysm, which doesn't tear, but it does predispose you to ventricular arrhythmias, as you mentioned. And the mechanism, we think, is that over time, the ventricle pressure is so high from a thickened muscle that it causes damage to the lining of the muscle itself. And when it causes that damage, that leaves scar behind. That scar is a trigger, and that trigger leads to ventricular arrhythmias. And this is data from around 2008, I think, when we first kind of describe this, where the ventricular aneurysms, the higher the risk for sudden death. And we still don't know the absolutes for this. How big does that have to be? How much scar in that aneurysm? But if we see it, it's enough for us to take a breath and talk to you about what that risk is. And it's mostly related to higher pressures inside the heart, a damage to the muscle itself, and the amount of fibrosis in that damage.
So that's the rare. Not many people have apical aneurysms, and that's not the risk for most people. We know we have identified multiple risk factors for ventricular arrhythmias and sudden cardiac arrest in those with HCM. You want to review what some of the higher risk factor markers are?
There are some easy ones, right? If you have a prior history of cardiac arrest, then you've earned yourself an ICD. Those are easy. If you have a sustained VT where you pass out from it, even if you didn't have cardiac arrest, that's enough to buy you a defibrillator. But then there are the ones that you're being restratified for. So you're seeing your doctor, and those are how thick the wall is. So 30 millimeters or thicker. We worry about a history of passing out, or what we call syncope, from a rhythm, from a documented rhythm, or something that sounds like it's from a rhythm itself. So for instance, if you have a wall thickness of 20, you clearly have HCM, and you go to get your blood drawn, or you watch a scary movie, or you watch somebody else get their blood drawn and you pass out, that's a different mechanism for syncope than saying, I was sitting quietly, I was walking across the room, my heart started to pound, the room started to cave, and I dropped over and somebody needed to revive me, and they started CPR. That would be a scarier rhythm. So ventricular tachycardia is the other one. So non-sustained VT, where we document that, where the bottom chamber has a rhythm that is sustained for at least 10 beats, faster beats, over 200 beats a minute, and then multiple in a 24-hour period. So when you're seeing your doctor, right, we're looking at the echo for function. We're looking at a monitor for rhythm changes. We do that every year or two, depending on who you are and what your risk might look like. Wall thickness over 30 millimeters, we worry about. And we also worry about the amount of scar. When we're doing the MRI, we're looking for an accurate measurement of scar. We're also looking for an accurate measurement of wall thickness, because we know that it's better than echo at both of those things. And then we mentioned that apical aneurysm, family history of sudden death. So if you've got a family history in a patient with HCM who has sudden death, I'm worried about you. And we need to tease out whether or not that was truly related to HCM or not. The final one, I think, is LV dysfunction, where the pumping chamber drops below 50%. That is also rare. But when it happens, we all pause.
Family history questions. That can get confusing sometimes.
Yeah.
We know that the guidelines are very clear on first degree relatives, but what we learn from our second degree relatives can potentially be informative as well. So we want to look at that family history very closely. We want to know mechanism of death. I actually did a reels on this through Heart Month about why it's important to know not only when somebody in your family may have passed away and whether or not they had a diagnosis of any heart problems, but how they died, whether it was stroke, whether it was heart failure, whether it was sudden, what happened, because that might indicate your individual risk or risks other places in the family.
Yeah, and we teach the fellows and we teach patients even to talk about, I want to know about a family member who died in a car accident that nobody understood. How about a swimming accident? Uncle Joe went for a swim. He was a good swimmer, but he died anyway. Or Aunt Sally was a runner and she went for a run and she never came back. Those are, you know, car accidents, unexplained deaths. Those are often a little, they're hard to dig into, but they are worth having that discussion. And most of us don't do a great job of knowing our family history. It's an opportunity while maybe mom and dad or brothers and sisters are still alive to try and dig into that. I had this conversation with my dad and he said, well, we have hardening of the arteries. And I said, all right, well, which ones? He said, what do you mean? I said, the ones in your heart, the ones in your head, the ones in your legs. He was like, I don't know. We always just said hardening the arteries. So this is a chance for you to dig into your family history, how they die, what was happening, what were the circumstances. And maybe it was that they weren't being a good steward, right? They were overweight, they smoked, they had poorly controlled diabetes. Well, all right, that's helpful. But maybe it's that they were the opposite of that. They were really healthy. They looked healthy from the outside, as we always talk about the HCMers hiding. And you look superb on the outside, but on the inside, there's something looming, and it's a chance to try and dig into that.
The other thing I want to talk about is mechanism of syncope. So taking bigger words and breaking them down smaller, why did you faint? And if you fainted because you're obstructed, that doesn't necessarily mean that you need an ICD, because your faint was hemodynamic in nature and not arrhythmic in nature. So I've seen a lot of patients go very quickly from diagnosis because of a syncopal episode to an ICD. And I look at them and say, well, the ICD may not have been 100% necessary, because your syncopal episode probably wasn't due to an arrhythmia. It was due to a volume shift. Can you explain how important it is to understand the mechanism of a fainting episode to help assess risk?
It's all about the history. When you're learning about syncope or from a doctor's standpoint, they say by the time you get to the end of the history, if you don't know what the cause is, start over, because it's all about the story. Was it a frightening event? Was it a blood draw? But did they watch a car accident? Did they get scared? Those are more benign syncopes. What some people refer to as vasovagal syncope, or a neurally mediated syncope is probably more accurate. Some people refer to this as church syncope. You see this in hot churches, standing up too long. You see military recruits pass out in front of the palace, the big beef eaters. Sometimes they pass out because they're standing too long. Blood pools in the legs, doesn't fill up your heart any longer. If you're an HCMer, that can even be more worrisome, because the blood pools, the ventricle empties, you can pass out. That's what hydration is all about. I need to know the mechanism 100%. And then if it isn't that, I want to know, was it unprovoked? Were you sitting quietly? Were you running? Was this during exertion? And then during exertion, I want to tease out, was this obstruction or was this an arrhythmia? And that's going to require a little more work on our part.
It's been coming up quite a bit lately. As HCM is gaining notoriety, I will call it, in the clinical realm. So we're doing a better job at diagnosing HCM because more doctors are looking for it. They're also not very skilled in HCM. So they see HCM, somebody passed out and they freak out and they immediately go to introduce them to the EP department who may not have great knowledge on HCM and boom, they got a device and you're going, okay, but why? And I've been challenged a lot in the past couple of weeks with the, why is the ICD there?
Yeah.
So we want to be good stewards of healthcare. We don't want to be putting people at risk of putting in devices that have risk over life. They protect some people, but they also have risk. So you want to make sure that the right devices and the right therapies are going to the right people at the right time.
Perfectly said. I mean, I think they are wonderful. They are lifesavers, no pun intended. They are really important. But if we put one in everybody, we're going to cause harm. And a lot of times it is done due to fear rather than some science. And we do know that it's not a perfect science. It's not a perfect risk stratification, but that we can work together to try and sort through that to try and come up with what the best plan is for you. And age really matters, right? So I lose more sleep under the under 20s, the under 30s, than I do the over 50s, the over 60s. You can certainly have risk over the age of 60, but most of the risk stratification data is 68 years and below. Mm-hmm. And you want to spend some time, if you're over 60, to try and convince yourself that this is an appropriate response. Most people over the age of 60 don't die suddenly from this disease.
Somebody popped in that she's listening, and I happen to know that the person listening has a device and has had it appropriately save her life. There have been amazing advances in technology in the 28 years of the HCMA. I have had 5 implantable devices before my transplant. I love ICD therapy. It has saved so many people. Dr. Murawski, who's the man who created the ICD, I think of him often. Most people may not think of him very often, but I do. And to Dr. Barry Marin, who helped identify risk stratification in HCM and who should be getting ICDs. He's done us a great service. So props to Barry and to all of those who helped evolve the knowledge of who should be getting an ICD. So we're so glad that so many of you are being protected against life-threatening arrhythmias with your devices and your medical therapy. So let's just take a few minutes to wrap up this arrhythmia podcast with what medications are we using to treat ventricular arrhythmias in HCM?
In terms of sudden death benefit, it's all about the ICD. There aren't, you know, the days of saying, I'm going to save you by being on certain medication is not accurate any longer. The ICD is the stronghold for this. Beta blockers, metoprolol, toprol, propranolol, those are good options for you to suppress VT. And that's mostly for symptoms. If you've got short bursts for this, we usually treat it. And then amiodarone is probably the go-to for ventricular arrhythmias to suppress this. We can certainly suppress this with sotalol sometimes too. PVCs in particular, I've certainly used this for that. But for the most part, it's going to be beta blockers to control the rate, to suppress those. And then it's always, what's the cause of this? As I want to make sure that, is this progression of disease? Is there more scar? Are we headed in the wrong direction? Should we be treating obstruction? Is there coronary disease, right? The most common reason people still die, especially as you get older, is blockages in the heart arteries. So don't forget about the good stuff, right? That you, the controlling hypertension, controlling cholesterol, diabetes, and heart artery disease. So you want to make sure you stay broad. But I think the mainstay of medical therapy for this is going to be a beta blocker, amiodarone, and then sometimes sotalol in those selected cases.
We're also hearing from a Facebook user who has had positive and negative experiences with her ICDs. And I know she's commenting on 2 different platforms. So I know who this is, and I know that she's been saved by her ICD. And these stories are amazing to me. Every time somebody calls and says, hey, my device went off, it saved my life, I smile a little bit and say, another one saved, and we've done a good job. But it would be really nice if we could stop these arrhythmias from happening. We talk about, you know, new therapies, new things coming to HCM, And I'm asked very frequently, will myosin inhibitors lower my arrhythmia risk? Yeah. And my answer is, we don't know yet. But what do you think?
I think what you said is right. We don't know yet. So you could come up with a hypothesis that by reducing LVOT obstruction, you reduce long-term stiffness, which may potentially lower the risk of fibrosis. Sure. We could say that it also, in some cases, we've seen dramatic changes in ECGs and wall thickness, where the wall thickness has gotten thinner and it really has improved the wall thickness and the diastolic parameters. Maybe that's going to lower the risk for sudden death. We know that if you have scar, there's no data to suggest that the CMIs, no matter which one it is so far, will reduce the scar burden. So it's not removing scar. Once you get it, it's yours to keep. And then we hope that it just doesn't progress. But right now, there's nothing to suggest that. And I think of CMIs as being an important way to treat obstruction and improving symptoms, but we're not there yet for anything else. And the ICD is the gold standard for this. And it's really been a game changer for HCM, as you point out. Those who sorted through this have saved countless lives. You and I know multiple folks who we have put ICDs in, and within a couple of months have had an event that had saved their life. So there's no question, I am an ICD fan, but you just have to be mindful that just dropping one in every individual is probably not, it isn't the right answer.
It isn't. And even when you have multiple risk factors, the device may never go off. I found something in a pile of papers recently. And it's one of those things where I look at with my knowledge of today and say, wow, I'm glad I didn't know this then in a certain sense. I found my echocardiogram from July 1990. I was a scary person on paper. I'm going to tell you that right now. So I was 21 years old. I was recovering from my endocarditis. I had just had a stroke. And this echo, my wall measurement was 3.0 and my gradient was 65 at rest. And you could still see the vegetation on the valve. And I'm like, damn. Yeah. She went through some things before she gave up. She held on for a long time. But here I was at 21 with a wall measurement that big. My ICD was not in yet. I didn't even have a pacemaker at this point, that nothing was done. It would be 7 years until I got my first ICD. And I had an ICD for 20 some odd years, and it never went off. First time it went off, it was in my hand after my transplant. So it shocked my finger, not my heart. And it never went off.
Yeah.
But I was protected. So yeah. When my heart would do a wonky thing, I would not panic. And I knew I was protected. And I'm very happy that members of my family are protected with ICD therapy, because we've lost multiple members to sudden cardiac arrest.
Right.
So it's not a guarantee that it's going to go off. And as soon as you get an ICD put in, you just assume that it's going to go off like the next week. I went like 25 years and it never did a thing.
Yeah, it's the craziest part about the disease. It's so heterogeneous in its presentation. Even within the same family, it can vary. Where we have a family that you and I know a long time that put an ICD in for a cardiac arrest in a young family member at 16, put the defibrillator in his two younger siblings. They didn't have an event, one till she was 21 and one till they were 28. But it provided them safety. It provided them peace of mind. It allowed them to travel. That's what shared decision making is all about. Let's talk about you. Let's talk about your age. Tell me about your family. What's your risk aversion to this? And then, of course, as you know, I have others who have multiple risk factors who I lose sleep over, who say, I don't want a defibrillator.
I know. And that's okay.
That's a choice.
That's okay. As long as you can sleep at night and you feel confident and you're okay with the alternative. I spoke to a gentleman a couple of weeks, well, it's probably about a year or two ago now. Time flies in my head. But he has early signs of Alzheimer's. And he's like, you know, I'd rather die suddenly than have a protracted disease process. So I'm not going to put in an ICD. And I'm okay with that. And he's like, don't try to talk me into a device. I'm like, dude, I'm not here to talk anybody into anything. Here's your knowledge. You made your decision, and I respect that, and I've got your back. Everybody makes their own decisions. So somebody's commenting now that they had a Holter monitor that didn't show any abnormalities, but their EF is 35%. Doesn't that buy you an ICD?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, I would want to make sure we're talking about the same cardiomyopathy, that Correct. You truly have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and not a dilated cardiomyopathy. But honestly, either way, with an EF of 35, you've got to really, whether it's dilated HCM, ischemic, or otherwise, you've got to have a conversation with your doctor about an ICD or not. If you have HCM, you're already into ICD land by a lot. And honestly, an EF of 35 in HCM should is scary for me. So you need to talk to your doctor. It'd be great to have a conversation with them today to ask them about what we're missing.
Yeah. So,
and I don't know who that is, but I don't even know where you live. But I think that's a phone call for sure.
Yeah. Vinya, who's watching on X or Twitter, you can call the office. We'd be more than, so you have end-stage HCM. So hopefully you've met an advanced heart failure team, you're being worked up or considered for heart transplantation, and that you've got your ICD to protect you and keep you safe while that process is going forward. If you have any questions, please call the office. We're happy to help align you with any care provider that you might find beneficial. So number one, myosin inhibitors and atrial arrhythmias. There's some signs. There was a paper at ACC or AHA about AFib post-myosin inhibitor loading. What are we seeing? What do we know about AFib risk in myosin inhibitor?
Yeah, so it's a important question. And there's certainly a signal in the original trial of about 5% of folks who had atrial fib after mavacamten. We don't know the answer to that for the newest one, aficamten, just yet. That's not been shown yet, may or may not. The extended, I think it was the OLE, showed that the rate of atrial fib may even be higher than 5%. So it is definitely a signal that makes us nervous. But if you go back to the beginning of this podcast, we said that atrial fib is so common in this condition. Is it just atrial fib and you happen to be on mavacamten? Or is that the mavacamten is driving more atrial fib? We don't know, and no one knows the answer to that. But that signal gives us all pause to pay attention to that. I think you'll see some more data on that. But if you take a breath and on the a step back on the mechanism, if you look at other things that we've done, like removing LVOT obstruction by surgery, long-term, that seems to lower the risk for atrial fib. So mechanistically, you would think that myosin inhibitors that remove obstruction, and they do it well, should lower the risk of atrial fib long-term. I would say stay tuned. There's more to come, and I think we're going to learn quite a bit about this. Maybe there's something about the medicine itself that changes the milieu of abnormal atria in HCM that leads to more atrial fib, and maybe in those who have had atrial fib, that's a reason to go towards surgery first. And you do a maze and do all those things. So I think there's more work to be done with that. But whoever wrote that is correct. There is definitely a signal.
We've seen a couple of people kind of go into more from paroxysmal or comes and goes AFib to more of a persistent AFib. But left atrial dimension does seem to be the underpinning driver as to who might pop and stay in AFib. So knowing your left atrial dimension is critical when making decisions. I wish HCM was easy. I wish we said, okay, here's your disease, here's your drug, have a nice day, moving on now. But there's so many nuanced differences between each individual anatomy that this is why I thought years ago, and I believe it today more than ever, high volume, center of excellence care, and the assessment of your individual anatomy are critically important to ensure that you're getting the right care for your heart and that your family's getting the right care for their hearts. Yeah. So
Barry told me years ago, when I first met him, he said, well, how long have you been doing this? I said, I think at that time it was 2 or 3 years. And he was like, all right, well, usually somewhere between 7 to 10 years, you really get a handle on this disease. And he's right. It's thousands of patients and subtleties and nuances. And I'd like to tell you that this is a, you know, every day is a straightforward day. Of course, I know all the answers, but that's not true. I'm still learning from the patients. And I think all the new therapies and things going forward, we're going to learn even more.
I will let that be the final comment for that piece. But I will also remind you all of Malcolm Gladwell's book, 10,000 Hours. And I've done the calculation, ladies and gentlemen, and after training and clinical evaluation and management and these practices grow, 600 patients with HCM equates to about 10,000 hours of clinical time. And those two numbers match towards the higher level of excellence in management, understanding, and treatment. And some of our programs are working towards that first 600 right now, and some of them have far exceeded those 600 patients. So depending upon who you are and where you are, we want you to see the highest volume you have access to, and we've also provided the Lori Fund to help you with travel expenses if you need to get to a higher level center to have your HCM heart evaluated. So Matt, go back to those NFL players and take care of all of those hearts. And thank you for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to join us on Tales from the Heart, a podcast from the HCMA. And thanks to all of our sponsors. You can see them listed on our website. So thank you all and have a great month. It's March and hopefully the weather's going to break and we'll be able to get outside and exercise more soon.